As in all stories of this kind, the knots are sometimes a little difficult to unravel, and the statements that some people make almost flatly contradict those of others. This can partly be put down, of course, to bad memory, but just as often to the simple fact that no two people ever see any situation in exactly the same way. Well, the one thing that can be said with certainty is that America has always had a strong tradition in vocal groups. In the 50s, there have been the R&B-inspired groups like the Spiders.
I'm so sad, I'm so blue.
And the Jewels.
Get out of my way.
In pop, there have been groups like the Platters.
Oh, yes, I'm the great pretender. But no one can tell.
And the Diamonds, who produced a smoother version of a song that had been an R&B hit for the Gladiolas. And many, many more. As well as these, however, there were the more sophisticated jazz-orientated groups like the Hi-Lows.
Life is just a bowl of cherries. When you go, go.
And the group that Brian Wilson admired so much, the Four Freshmen.
Ooh.
In fact, when Brian was 14, the Four Freshmen were playing someplace in Hollywood. I can't think of the club. And Murray took him. We couldn't afford to take Murray, Brian, and me. We really didn't have very much money. So Murray took Brian this one particular, I think it was a Sunday night, just in the hopes that he could meet them, because he was so thrilled with their music. And he was already writing vocal arrangements, even though he hadn't had any musical training. And he did get to meet them. And then years later, when they were the Beach Boys, they remembered having met Murray and Brian about 5 years previous to that.
That was Audrey Wilson, the mother of the three Wilson brothers. But as Beach Boy Mike Love points out, their own music, when it evolved, was a blend of two very different influences.
The influences that were upon the group in our formative years, I mean, in our youngest years, before we were the Beach Boys, were Chuck Berry, in terms of the alliterative kind of the way of his lyrics and the rhythm that he put down, but a blend of that and the more developed harmonies of the Four Freshmen, which evolved into our style, which was identified as a surfing sound, and some people call it surfing sound, some people call it West Coast sound.
In the 50s, the term West Coast sound had been synonymous with the soft sounds of cool jazz, which was ideal for just lazing about in the sunshine, particularly on the beach. But by the early 60s, a new sport had hit the coastline. The sport was, of course, surfing, defined on the back of the Beach Boys' first album as a water sport in which the participant stands on a floating slab of wood resembling an ironing board in both size and shape and attempts to remain perpendicular while being hurtled towards the shore at a rather frightening rate of speed on the crest of a huge wave. The excitement of the sport obviously demanded an energetic form of music. One person who set out to provide this music was an enthusiastic surfer named Dick Dale. He decided to form a band called the Deltones and run dances for the teenage surfers in the evenings. He adopted the raunchy rock and roll style of the late 50s and wrote some tunes that were supposed to reflect the surfing sport. He came up with titles like Surfing Drums, Death of a Gremmy, Mizzaloo Twist, Let's Go Trippin', and this one, Surf Beat.
Yeah,
Well, whether or not that sound conjures up the image of surfing is obviously a matter for debate, but there's no doubt that the music itself was popular with the surfing community. Incidentally, Dick Dale is obviously a talented musician, for apart from playing a right-handed guitar left-handed, he's also reputed to have played every instrument on his records. He also sang on some of the numbers, but if his version of Sloop John B is anything to go by, he certainly had little of the Beach Boys' vocal flair. Anyway, some of his audiences developed a special dance called the Surfer Stomp, the most popular form of which involved a series of three sidesteps, followed by a hop and a shuffle. It's said that the dancers were supposed to resemble bobbing surfers, trying to keep their balance on speeding surfboards, and there was even a record release called the Surfer Stomp by another group, the Marquettes. Surfer Stomp by the Marquettes, released in January 1962. Now that sounds ideal for dancing, but didn't somehow seem to capture any of the atmosphere or the excitement of surfing itself. But the sport was exciting, and had also started a new in language full of surfing terms. Here's Dennis Wilson.
Well, they used to have the hang ten. That's the famous one. You run up to the tip of the board and put both of your feet over the end of the board. You know, but now the boards are so small, you can't do that. You can stay in only one position, or your feet are fairly much stable. You can move them a bit, but not a whole bunch. Backsliding, 360, cut right or left, kick out, spinner. There's, you know, it's like in anything else, you know, like driving a car, you have a left or a right, you put on the brakes, you know, stall your board, you know. All the terms, you know.
So it was obvious that somebody just had to sing about it. Carl Wilson of the Beach Boys.
The first thing I seem to remember is Dennis and Michael going to the beach one day, a long time ago. And when they came back, they were talking about making a song about surfing and going to the beach. That's the first thing I remember about it. As far as the reality of a group, you know, of us actually forming. But
What time is this? What year is this?
Oh, it's in 61. Mm-hmm. The fall of 61. But before that, we'd always, you know, got around the piano to sing, and we'd go Christmas caroling, and we've always been into music somehow for many years.
Mm. So how did you actually decide to go about pulling the band together and getting it started?
Well, just said, well, let me see, Dennis and Mike and Brian, and Carl, and Brian had a friend, Al, and that was, you know,
right.
It was really simple.
Which is quite funny, since the way Al Jardine relates it, the forming of the group was far from simple. How did the band first come together?
I bet you asked everybody else the same question. That's good, because you get a cross-section of different opinions on how it got together. Each guy started the group, right?
Well, yes, I started the group.
No, from my point of view, it started when I met Brian Wilson. Brian and I were in rival singing groups in Hawthorne High School in Hawthorne, California, in 1959. I always admired what he did. You know, I knew that there was something happening there with his arrangements and the way he, you know, carried himself. And so after we left high school, I went off to college in the East. And I couldn't find anybody that I was really happy with, just to get together with, to sing and to harmonize and to make music. So I just hunted Brian down. I bumped into him at El Camino College. My second year of college, came back west. My father was teaching at this other place. We came back to California to pursue another line of work, and I ended up back in Los Angeles. Went to El Camino, and I was walking across the campus, and boom, there's Brian. I said, Brian, let's do it. Let's get together. And up to that point, I'd seen Brian, I think, a year previous at a hamburger stand. You can believe that. And I dropped the word then. I said, let's get together, but I'm going back east for a year. So he said, fine, I'll see you later, you know. So this was later. Let's do it. We got together the next day in the nurse's room. It's like a medical area of the college. So we got together a football player, some deep bass singer who couldn't carry a tune, one of my friends from early high school days in my other group, and we all got together and just sang just anything we could think of. Well, that group didn't cut it too well. That group of people just didn't make it, so we had a little refinement to do. So Brian said, hey, my little brother Carl can really sing, you know. He's really good. I says, him? Are you kidding? I saw him once at high school, and he was about 3 foot tall. You know, he's about 12. And it's short, and it just looks so funny. I just said to myself, yeah. He says, yeah, he's young, but he's really talented, he said. I says, all right, this is great. And he says, and my cousin Mike and Maureen, are, you know, they can sing, too. And there's Dennis, you know, and Dennis is like to do something. So we went over to Brian's the day after that, met with Mike and Dennis and Carl. And he wrote a couple of songs about a girl he was going with. One was called Judy. One was called Surfer Girl. And the other two tunes we did were Luau and Surfing. That was it. And Surfing became our A-side on our first record.
Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now.
So the Beach Boys had their first record out, extolling the joys of surfing. Most of the surfing addicts had their favourite beaches, and Dennis Wilson used to go to
Malibu, Hermosa, and Redondo, which is on the southern part of the United States, west coast, southern side.
How much of your influence got into the Beach Boys music in that time?
I think lyrically there was an influence, you know, an idea. It was about it. I didn't participate in the writing at that time at all.
In fact, that first single, like the second, was written by Brian Wilson with Mike Love. The first one, Surfin', had been released on a small local label called Candix and had been a minor local hit. Incidentally, it was Russ Regan at Candix who gave the group their name. The names The Pendletones and Carl and the Passions were never really seriously considered. But the Beach Boys' manager, Murray Wilson, decided that they could become more successful by joining one of the major labels.
My dad spent a lot of time going around to labels. Of course, we'd never had any experience in the music business, although he had a publisher whose name was Height Morgan. And Height helped my father to go to the bigger labels. I guess they just went all over wherever they could get in. But, you know, the thing is, you can't just go to a company. They have to say, well, yes, we'll see you and we'll talk and like that. So I think it was somewhat difficult. And Height finally gave up and my dad kept at it. And ended up at Capitol Records, and there was a guy there named Nick Vinay.
When he did call me, I told him I'd be out of town for about 2 weeks. I was going to Nashville myself. And I don't know why, but in the future, I guess the old man thought that that was a starting point, having to wait 2 weeks to see someone. But, well, anyway, he came up to the tower with the record, this building here, and they came into my office, and they had a demo of Surfing Safari. And they played it for me, and every once in a while, as a producer, every once in a while, before the second eight bars have spun around, you know that the record is the number one record, whether it's a commercial, whether it's whatever, there's something about it. And I wasn't one for hiding my feelings. I mean, if I wanted to drive a bargain, I should have just sat there mum. But I got all excited, and I started jumping around, and I said, we have to make the deal. And, of course, he got all excited, because he wasn't one to hide his feelings either. The old man wasn't. And the kids were sitting outside, as you can see right outside the door. And so I ran down the hall and knocked on the door of the, at that time, Vice President Voyle Gilmore. And I said, Voyle, I have to see you for 2 minutes. And he says, I'm really busy. I said, well, I got to see you. We got a hit record here. And if they walk out of the office, I don't even know where to call them. He says, well, all right, put it on. So I put it on a turntable. And even though that man was in his 50s, okay, he was a professional record man, you know. He heard what I heard evidently right away. And he said, well, go back and ask them what they want for it. But for God's sake, quit dancing. I mean, I was just so excited. And so I came back and I asked him what they wanted to consummate the deal. And the father asked for $300. And I went back again. I told him to stay put. And I just scared death. He'd walk out of the office. And I went back and I said, they want $300. He said, that's too much money. Now, you've got to remember, this is in the early 60s. $300 was a lot of money, evidently, for a record that wasn't a pop record with some magic sequin-dressed star singing type, you know, for a bunch of greasers, you know. And I said, oh, well, you gotta, we can't go in and argue with the man. $300 is, it would cost us $300 to make it here. He insisted I ask him to sell it for $100. So I was really despondent because I didn't want to bargain with the man. So I came back in and I said, they'll give you $100. And I said, but I don't think that's fair. I mean, I just, it was a turncoat. I said, I'll give you $300 right here. So I went back up the office again. I told the vice president, I said, listen, I'm going to resign and buy this record and start my own company. And it took about 15 minutes arguing with me, and he talked me into staying, and he came up with he said $300 is all right. I still think it was awfully cheap, even at $300.
Let's go surfing now. Everybody's learning how. Come on a safari with me.
So the Beach Boys had their first single out on the Capitol label in the summer of 1962. Although Capitol's promotion director Al Corey's version of how it got there isn't quite the same as Nick Vinay's.
Now this is the truth. I don't know what Nick told you, because this is the truth. Nick was very interested in one of the sides, which was 409, the hot rod side. He didn't care too much about the surfing stuff or the other music that was in the content. Now Vinay took the four sides in to Paul Gilmore, who was then the head of A&R at Capitol. And he played the four sides, and he said to him, I really want to buy these records because I want 409. And so, of course, the price was very reasonable, and Gilmore authorized him to buy the records.
Well, whatever the reason, the decision as far as Capitol was concerned was the right one. It is true that they initially promoted 409, but after a few weeks, they turned the record over and got behind Surfin' Safari. Nick Vinay again.
We released the record, and in the period of one day, the company knew it was a hit record. I mean, they don't happen that fast. But that record was a hit in a matter of hours. I mean, 8 hours after it was in the field, we were getting reports from isolated spots like in Phoenix, Arizona. You couldn't go surfing in Phoenix if you tried. And yet the record was selling. I think the biggest order Capitol had had that entire year had been on the Beach Boy record in New York City, where there's absolutely no surfing. The response was tremendous. It was just an instant smash, and it just sold close to 800,000 records. It didn't qualify for a gold record. In those days, you had to sell 1 million units. Today, you do $1 million worth of business, and you get a gold record.
Maybe not a gold record, but a sizable hit, and the next move was to make an LP. But already there had been a change in the lineup of the group. Al Jardine.
I left the group right at that point when the group went to Capitol. Mm. I made a decision that I didn't want to really put a big investment into equipment, and at the same time, I wanted to finish dental school. So, boom, okay, Al Jardine leaves the group, and there's David Marks for a year.
So it was David Marks who appeared on the first four albums. The first one was called Surfin' Safari, and as well as the title track, it included 409, their first single Surfin', Ten Little Indians and County Fair, the two sides of their second single release in England, and this hymn to root beer.
Here a mug, there a mug, everybody chug a lug. Here a mug, there a mug.
At this time, the Beach Boys were still doing the local hops in Southern California. Various other vocal groups were now getting into the music, and one of these was an all-girl group originally called the Ravel Sisters, later known as the Honeys.
My sister and my cousin and I were starting to sing together. We wanted to, you know, make records. And I actually met Brian at a coffee house, which was called Pandora's Box. They were all on stage singing. It was this little tiny coffee house. And he spilled hot chocolate all over me. I was actually drinking hot chocolate, and he asked me for a sip of it while he was, you know, like in between a song. And he spilled it all over me. That's how we met.
And some while later, Marilyn Ravel became Mrs. Brian Wilson. The fact that there were imitation groups was proof enough that the music of the Beach Boys had made a real impression by 1963. Nick Vinay.
It was a shot in the arm to the entire industry. I mean, they were just, there was a new form of, I hate the word, but I'll use it, teenage music, as they called it. Had nothing to do with your girlfriend breaking up or you driving off a cliff in your Chevrolet. It had nothing to do with any of that. It was a pure California phenomena. This is not like a state, it's like a country. Being California is like a nationality. And I think the Beach Boys just represented to the rest of the country California or something, or some sort of fantasy that was out there that just got triggered by the Beach Boys records. But the sales were overwhelming.
Renee Wexler is now married and living in New York, but in 1963 she was one of the youngsters in Southern California.
The Beach Boys represented a time in Southern California, and I believe now, after living away from Southern California, after talking to people who have grown up in different parts of the country, it also affected them, because kids that were growing up in Michigan were listening to Beach Boys songs and thinking, wow, that's the way it is in Southern California. And people who were 2,000 miles away from an ocean were wearing the Pendleton shirts and the blonde hair and the whole thing. It was a great time to be a teenager. It was fun. It was innocent.
Well, Mike Love said earlier in the program that Chuck Berry was the group's other great influence, and so with this third hit, Surfin' USA, they'd carried this to its logical conclusion by actually using one of his tunes, Carl Wilson.
The Sweet Little 16 was just a great tune, and so Brian just did an arrangement of it, and we changed it around. Mm. Brian and Michael did. And Chuck Berry wasn't personally involved in that.
Although, of course, he is credited as the writer on the record. The interesting point here is that Chuck Berry's music had evolved from the black working class areas, whereas many people considered the Beach Boys' music as essentially middle class.
America has an enormous middle class. We're using the word middle class and not in a pejorative sense. At the same time, to most people, middle class is a put-down. I don't know, Americans don't want to be poor and they don't want to be middle class, and they don't want to be rich. I don't know what they want to be. They just don't want to be called either one, evidently. But middle class is really a swipe at most Americans. And I think the Beach Boys were the first ones to capture the American middle class youth fantasy. First off, at that period of time, it was a very rich time for America. Most all kids drove to school in Chevrolets, Corvettes, I mean, $5,000-$6,000 cars, especially California, middle class kids. And it was middle-class music. I think surfing is a middle-class sport. I think Brian is a first-generation American middle-class. And I know he's going to think this is a put-down, but it's not. It's a sociological aspect. I think he did represent middle-class American youth, and he captured their imagination.
It really was innocent. We enjoyed things. I mean, we had our parties and, you know, we'd run out in the morning to watch our boyfriends surf. And it was an innocent time. When you look at that time today, it's almost as if it was 1,000 years ago. It seems as though it belongs in another era, because it was bright. It was cheerful. There was nothing ominous. And your whole interest in life, actually, was, well, you know, will the surf be up? Will the sun be out? And will I have enough allowance to put gas in the car? Not will the gas be there, but will I have enough allowance to pay for the gas to get to the beach? And you pool your resources with your friends. So they really represented a whole lifestyle. In other words, that lifestyle had begun. I mean, that whole surfing world in Southern California, that had started before the Beach Boys got together. But they were able to put those feelings and those times into words and into music, the things that we wanted to hear. You know, they were talking about us, Surfer Girl. I mean, when Surfer Girl came out, it was just like, oh, that's me or something. And that's the way we used to be. That's where, oh, they wrote that song about me. You know, little surfer, little one. I mean, that was the whole thing. It was crazy.
Surfer Girl, I think, probably carried as much of a feeling as anything we've ever done. I mean, just the way that it came on, you know, it's a very dumb track, you know, just the guitars and the bass and drum. But it just carried something, you know, when the vocal came in, it had some feeling, it had a spiritual thing in it. And that's a special tune for Brian.
Carl Wilson. So far, we've heard about the Beach Boys' surfing music, but we haven't heard much about the other side of their output. Here's Renee Wexler again.
Most Southern California high schools were divided up between the surfers, who, you know, everyone sort of put a bottle of peroxide on their hair and became surfers, and the greasers, which were the car clubs and, you know, the sort of, you know, low riders, people that, not really hoodlums. I don't want to say that. They weren't bad kids, but they were sort of the James Dean type. And so every school in Southern California was divided up between these two factions. But at the same time, there was a change also going on in the surfing community. The kids that were surfing then also became interested in cars besides their surfing. So in other words, the surfing kids wanted to hear the car songs and be true to your school. And of course, at the same time, they did bring over the greasers, the car boys, the ones that were painting their Chevys metallic green with orange flames and, I mean, that sort of thing. So they really got the whole audience.
She's real fine, my poor.
The Beach Boys were now firmly established as a live act in Southern California, but even by the early summer of 1963, they had yet to test their popularity elsewhere. Up in Sacramento in Northern California, Fred Vail had taken on the task of raising money for a local high school. He decided to do it by holding a concert.
So I decided, well, I think I'll check out this Beach Boy thing, you know, because they sound like they'd really be fun to work with. They're all young guys, and the music is quite good, and I like their vocal thing. And so I called around Los Angeles and finally found out that William Morris Agency, which is, of course, one of the world's largest talent agencies, had just signed the group, and they were going to be representing the group worldwide. So I said, I'd like to buy the group. And he says, well, are you in Los Angeles? I said, no, it's going to be for a concert in Sacramento, California, which is about 400, 450 miles north. And he said, well, I'll talk to their father, Murray Wilson, who handles the boys, and we'll see if we can get together on a date. So I gave them a date or two and decided that we would have the show in May, which was, a month or so before school was to let out for summer. So they presented the offer to the boys, and the boys agreed to do the show. But then they realized that they had to fly or drive north, and they were used to just doing neighborhood functions where they could all hop in the family car and throw the amplifiers and guitars in the trunk and leave. So the Morris Agency came back to me and asked me if I would be willing to pay for either 6 round-trip airline tickets or increase the fee to $750. And not wanting to get involved in airline tickets and other expenses and things like that, I said, well, fine, I'll just give the boy $750 flat. And within 3 or 4 weeks, I presented the Beach Boys for what was probably to become their first feature concert with them as the star headline attraction. And this was in May of 1963. I really felt that I was just one of the gang, and I met the Beach Boys at the plane, and I can remember the boys and Murray, their father, getting off the plane, and we all went over and went over to the baggage claim area to pick up the musical instruments and the amplifiers. And here are the 5 Beach Boys who ranged in age at that time from approximately 15 or 15 and a half to 22, 23. Mike Love, I believe, was the oldest. Brian was not with the group at this particular engagement. Brian was home in Los Angeles. And Al Jardine was replacing Brian for that particular concert. Alan was really not a member of the group at that time. And we loaded the equipment into my station wagon, and we drove to the auditorium. We set up the equipment, and the boys went on. And at that time, the boys were doing 2 sets. They would go on and do a 40 or 45 minute show, and then there'd be an intermission, and then the boys would come back and do an additional 40 or 50 minute show. they didn't have enough of their own material to do two sets, and they were doing other people's material all the time. Al Jardine was singing the Del Shannon hit Runaway, and Dennis was doing one or two of Dion DiMucci's recordings. I think he was doing The Wanderer or Runaround Sue, and of course they were always closing their shows even back then with Johnny B. Goode, which is an old Chuck Berry classic, and they would do a Four Freshmen tune, a thing called Graduation Day, which showed their fantastic vocal harmonies.
Right now we'd like to do the song that was recorded several years ago by a group of singers who are very inspirational for our careers because they influence Brian Wilson and his writing. Their group is the Four Freshmen.
The Beach Boys' tribute to the Four Freshmen, recorded in Sacramento about a year after the concert Fred Vail promoted. But back to May 1963.
After the show was over, we went back to their hotel where they were staying, and we were all sitting around a large table talking about the concert and the reaction of the Beach Boys that evening, which was fantastic. Obviously, they had seen success in Los Angeles, but this was a city that was 400 or 500 miles away, and it wasn't near the ocean, and they just weren't quite expecting it. They were all thrilled. So we were all discussing the concert and the Beach Boys' success, and we were figuring out how much we would net out of the evening's performance. And having figured out their expenses for the evening, Murray told me that the boys had made about $52 apiece net after all the expenses and agency commission. And they asked me how much I had made. Well, I had made between $3,000 and $4,000 net. And Murray, along with the rest of the boys, were amazed that a kid, quote, myself, could put together a show and make this kind of money when they, as the performers, were only making a very, very minimal amount, particularly if you compared it to what I was making as a promoter. And I felt that there was really no reason why the Beach Boys should make thousands and thousands of dollars for promoters when it was really the Beach Boys who should be making that kind of money for themselves. And the William Morris Agency at the time was booking the boys for $250, $350, $500, $800 a night. And I foresaw promoters getting fat and rich off of the Beach Boys and their popularity. So I mentioned to Murray, if I can have this kind of a success in Sacramento, California, obviously there are other cities where the Beach Boys' popularity is just as great, and perhaps the Beach Boys should think about doing some of their own shows where they can actually promote their own concert dates. And Murray thought this was fantastic, and he thought it was a good idea, but he told me that he certainly couldn't give it the time necessary to go out on the road and set up shows and produce shows. So I said, well, heavens, I'm not doing anything. You know, let's enter into an agreement, and I'll go out and investigate and check out cities. And if I felt that the city warranted us putting up our money to front a show or promote a show, we would do that, and we would somehow or another devise a way of compensating me. Because here I am, 19, 20 years old, and that night was more money than I had ever seen as far as a one-night salary or one-night fee or one-night net. And I was quite anxious to continue my relationship with them, because even in 6 or 7 hours during that evening, or the course of the evening, I had become very, very attached to the Beach Boys and felt a very, very close relationship to them. What we actually set up in our brief conversation that night became the format, you might say, of American Productions, which was the Beach Boys' quite successful concert production firm. And the next show that we did together, they went from this $500 to $800 a night flat fee that the William Morris was booking them for to about $3,000 or better a night. And I can remember one evening coming back from an engagement and not being prepared to handle all the money that would come in that night at the box office. We had stuck dollar bills and change and $5 bills in our pockets and in briefcases, and we'd even resorted to shopping bags and regular paper sacks, you might say. We came back to the hotel, and we just dumped all this money on a big bed in the hotel room. And the boys were just totally in shock, bewildered to see $3,000 or $4,000 in cash, and it was all theirs, and they were excited as kids. It was like Christmas in May or June or July, whatever month it happened to be. I think it was November, as a matter of fact. And this, of course, was the beginning of their quick and rapid rise to popularity and the success that Murray and I had with these shows opened the eyes of agents and managers, the William Morris Agency, promoters all over the country, and people began to realize the potential impact of the Beach Boys and began to give serious consideration to the boys as a major attraction and not just a Southern California, quote, phenomenon. Catch a wave and you're sitting on top of the world.
Well, that was Catch a Wave from the Beach Boys' third LP, Surfer Girl. By this time, however, there was increasing disagreement between Murray and their record producer, Nick Vinay.
Of course, he was their father. Had he been a professional manager, unrelated to the group, I could have probably seen my way through the arguments and argued on a professional level and continued working with him. But because I was arguing with someone who was blood-related, whenever I told him he was wrong or foolish, the entire band took it as a slander against the family. So it was very difficult. And after the first few LPs and the first singles, I started becoming a coordinator for them here at Capitol. They were making their own records, and that was no fun for me. I like working with people, so gradually we just separated.
So as well as having control over their concert bookings, the Beach Boys and their father now had the freedom to make their own records, which proved an even more significant move.